Yale University, where she teaches undergraduates, graduate students, and medical students. Jason and Naomi, thank you so much for being on the show, for calling in from wherever in the city, in the world you may be right now. It looks like, are you all calling in from your respective homes or offices?
Yes, we are.
Yes.
Excellent. Well, I really appreciate you coming on the show and for helping our listeners understand a bit more about the context that surrounds this pandemic that we find ourselves in the thick of right now. I want to hear your general responses, but first I want to lead with something that I heard the director of the city's parking authority say last night during their first meeting to be pushed into the virtual sphere since the mayor declared a state of emergency. They held a teleconference meeting last night in which they spoke about city parking garages and all the other things that the parking authority deals with. And the director said, we are dealing with a human scale event that we have not seen since the confluence of the Great War, the World War I, and the Spanish flu in 1919. And as two historians of medicine yourself, I wonder if what you think of that statement. Does this seem like that unprecedented of a moment or comparable to that confluence of a Great War and a pandemic a century ago? Or does this feel and look like something a little bit different? Maybe I'll go to Jason first, if that's okay, or if Naomi feels like it's a more appropriate question for her, go for it. But how about Jason, you're nodding. So I don't know. Does that seem like an appropriate statement?
I'll start, and then I'm sure Naomi can add some context as well. No, I think it's not exaggeration in terms of the scale of what we're encountering, the uncertainty surrounding what the coming weeks and months look like, as well as the level of response we're seeing here, appropriately so, in our communities and our nation around the world. So no two events are the same. It's hard. Comparisons are always filled with challenges when we think about historical events. But certainly the gravity of what we're living through now doesn't have a whole lot of recent predecessors in terms of both what we know and what we don't know. So I think it's in the ballpark.
I would actually, I've been thinking about this question myself. I think that I would say that this is the first global pandemic that I've lived through or consciously lived through. I think that AIDS, for example, was a global pandemic, for example, in the 1980s, but it really was not conceived that way by many countries, including ours, and so that instead it was seen more as a problem for certain places, certain cities, certain kinds of populations, in a way that COVID-19 has really been conceived of as an everyone's issue. And to think about that, you really do have to go back to think about the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic, in which similarly it was thought of as something that affected everyone, although when you look back you can see that the majority of demographically speaking were in fact young, healthy men and women were most at risk for that particular pandemic. But at the time, it was seen as something that threatened everybody.
Tell me a bit more about how that moment felt similar and different to now. Do you know why that was such a different demographic that was most vulnerable to the Spanish flu of the late teens? And obviously, as we hear more and more information about who is most vulnerable to this COVID-19 pandemic, it seems to be the elderly, immunocompromised. I know a lot of early reports about, especially out of China, about how very young children seem to be surprisingly resilient to this this particular virus. But Naomi, can you tell me a bit more about the similarities and differences in terms of who is affected between now and that?
This is one of the first questions that you hear populations asking whenever there is this kind of threatened disaster, which is, you know, who is likely to get it? And the other side, of course, is, am I safe, right? Who's likely to get it? Let it not be me. And in 1918, one of the issues was that large numbers of, in the U.S., large number of American troops were sent home from Europe, in which many of them had become infected, and they came, they had been sent to Europe from towns and cities all over the United States. And so, of course, they went back to their own communities and brought with them the infection. But more often, by the time they actually arrived at their own home, they themselves were sick. Some people have speculated that maybe there were also issues of stress and malnutrition for some of those young men, for example. I'm not sure that there's a great answer for that, but definitely this issue of who is vulnerable and how do we know, I think is a crucial part of trying to make sense of an epidemic. Jason, do you want to jump in there?
No, I think that's right, that that you know, there's the differences in the epidemiology of the diseases and in terms of just how they take hold in different populations. When and we know so much about the young children in 1918, which fortunately don't seem to be as severely affected. But even that knowledge is continuing to change in terms of who can transmit and who can be affected. It's really so much of learning as we go here. But it is a reminder that our outbreaks and our epidemics exist in this broader social and political and cultural context in the worlds in which we live in at any given moment. And they don't exist in a vacuum, as historians make their lives trying to elucidate, but they shape and are shaped by the worlds in which we're inhabiting, whether it's the World War I period of around 1918, whether it's this world of global commerce and easy global travel that we're living in today. So the work to situate epidemics in their context involves thinking about the environments in which they take hold, which goes well beyond just the healthcare system or the particulars of the biology of any particular virus or bacteria.
Now, a quick look at the CDC's website shows me that in the 1918-1919 Spanish flu, roughly 50 million people worldwide were infected, and an estimated 675,000 in the United States alone died. Obviously, those nowhere near those numbers in the early stages of the coronavirus now, with Johns Hopkins University saying that around 185,000 people worldwide have tested positive, and just over 7,000 have died. Jason, I see that one of your primary research interests is in the way, and I'm reading from your bio, the way in which evidence is interpreted, evaluated, and translated into regulation and policy in medicine and public health. Could you share a bit about what you know about how governments and how public health professionals, how healthcare providers responded to the Spanish flu at the time? What were the coordinated or, maybe uncoordinated efforts to stem that particular pandemic?
Yeah, no, it was a massive set of responses that are not dissimilar from the period in which we're living in today, reflected the fact that we didn't have the kinds of classic biomedical pharmaceutical interventions that we so increasingly rely upon in medicine today to prevent or to treat. We didn't have a vaccine. We didn't yet know that what influenza looked like as a virus. So the toolkit of that response is frankly, in the same ballpark as the toolkit of the responses we're thinking about today, what we now refer to as non-pharmaceutical interventions to reflect how much we think about sort of medical care as our bread and butter. But the 1918 response relied heavily upon limiting public movement, closing public spaces, shutting down large events differently in different cities and states, as we're seeing today. But it was relying on what now the term that we're all learning in the past few weeks of social distancing, and using those sort of classic public health practices to keep individuals away from each other, to try and keep the sick away from the healthy, was the massive response in the United States. And there's lots of evidence to show that cities who accelerated those responses earlier in the 1918 pandemic tended to have better outcomes, relatively speaking, again, this, it's all relative, than cities that were more cautious or arrived at these tools late in the game. So there's lessons around non-pharmaceutical interventions that have been studied and have been thought about in the context of more recent outbreaks and pandemics. And I think we're seeing some of the outgrowth of that knowledge here in our ongoing response.
Jason, one of the...
I was reflecting also on the 1916 polio epidemic, which came just before the influenza epidemic and was the biggest epidemic that the United States had ever seen at that time. And it was understood as a disease of children. And so there was a massive effort to isolate children and to institute public health measures that would enforce social distancing, because it was well recognized that you can't demand for children that they self-isolate themselves. And so movie theaters were closed for all children. Adults could still go. New Jersey's baby parades were canceled. There was a circus that had no children in the audience because the children were just banned from congregating. So it was a very powerful way of identifying who were considered the most vulnerable. And here I mean both potential transmitters of polio and also the potential victims.
I think a lot of news outlets have been focusing on one of the many challenges that the Trump administration has presented the public health world, and I think also largely the Republican Congress, is this issue of mixed messaging to the public. You have the governor of Oklahoma taking a picture of himself and his kids over the weekend at a crowded bar and restaurant and saying now is the time to support local businesses. You have Devin Nunes, a Republican congressman in California, going on Fox News and over the weekend saying, let's not punish small businesses because of the pandemic. If you're healthy, go out. Now, those players have largely changed their tune, with Trump even saying today that people should avoid gatherings of 10 people or larger. But Naomi, when you reflect on the 1916 polio epidemic and also the 1918-1919 Spanish flu, were politicians and public officials, kind of well-known personalities, were they engaged in the same kind of public information campaign to get those key messages out about how to avoid large places in order to stem the spread of the disease? Was there the same types of struggle? Obviously, we live in a vastly different communication sphere right now with the omnipresence of the internet and social media and all that stuff. But can you tell me a bit about that effort to get the word out from a centralized place to the broader public to stem the spread of the disease?
There were very effective communication strategies from local and state public health departments who had developed a whole series of techniques extensively for at least 20 or 30 years, which included things like messaging on movie theaters, where they would have special slides that had been designed by the local public health department, posters, pamphlets in many, many different languages. Remember, this is an era in the early 20th century of migrants or immigrants of many different kinds. And this was well recognized by public health departments. You didn't quite have the same kind of celebrity politicians largely who engaged in this particular issue, such as that I have seen in my research. But I will say that there was a well-recognized tension of the demands of some members of the public compared to the demands of the public health officials, so that, for example, as individual communities in both epidemics began to ban people from entering their neighboring towns, there was an effort to come up with health certificates so that if you had a health certificate, you could claim that you hadn't come from a dangerous area. But interestingly, a health certificate was not recognized as legitimate if it was signed by a private physician. It had to be signed by a recognized public health official who was assumed to be far more objective and less likely to have been swayed by the families of that particular member of the public. So certainly there were tensions recognized. I would say that it was seen, both of them were seen as both local and national at the same time, which I think is actually an appropriate way to think about an epidemic or a pandemic. Both local and national, in that case, the public health service, the sort of ancestors, as it were, of the CDC, were involved in monitoring the local and state responses, and they were taken pretty seriously.
Jason, you mentioned some of the non-pharmaceutical public health approaches back in a century ago to combat the Spanish flu. Could you speak a bit to the pharmaceutical and medical approaches in terms of the work on any vaccines that might have helped put an end to that pandemic, or what the medical community's response in a pharmaceutical way was to that?
Sure. So it was very sort of rudimentary at the time, given what was known and what wasn't known about influenza. But I have looked at this question about the idea of a vaccine, even in 1918, as we talk a lot about magic bullets in public health in terms of an easy fix to a complicated health problem. And even in 1918, 1919, where exactly what the influenza virus was frankly not well understood, there were many attempts to put together something purporting to be a swine flu vaccine that could be put out by city health departments to be a fix in addition to all of these other approaches. I think it's not dissimilar from the enthusiasm and excitement that we've seen throughout the intervening decades, whether it's the swine flu in 1976, which we might want to talk about, to even the hopes that in the early days of the HIV/AIDS pandemic that we might have a vaccine available in short order, a task that work that continues decades later, and the enthusiasm and excitement that we're seeing about the role a vaccine could play in this outbreak. So there has been a trend throughout the 20th and now 21st century of public health to looking for those medical fixes, those medical cures that can take this complicated problem and make it go away in a single shot or a single pill. In 1918, I think, was an early point in the enthusiasm, the excitement, and the hopes in those sorts of interventions that we continue to see a century later.
And as you reflect upon that pandemic a century ago, what do you think proved to be the most effective responses? You know, Ed, based on your research and the historiography around this now, what do you think were the most effective responses to that pandemic?
It was certainly involving that aggressive use of these social distancing strategies, the aggressive closing of public spaces, limiting public gatherings, creating, we think about sort of crowds as the accelerant to allow epidemics to translate, to transfer among communities. And the idea of giving individuals space from one another is one way to sort of tamp down the ability of whether it's the 1918 flu, whether it's the coronavirus today, that giving individuals space from one another is a low-tech but effective strategy to help with the response. So I think that's what the research that our colleagues and others have done has really illustrated, the effectiveness of those tools, as disruptive as they are to everyday life, as we're living through a century later, but the potency of those tools as part of a response in these early stages.
And like, Naomi, would you agree, or tell me what do you think is the most effective?
Because I think that one of the things that I'm noticing, especially in living through this pandemic, is and the examples of the Oklahoma governor and so on is reminding me of this as well, is how it is that the difficulty of convincing the public that certain that everyone is at risk. I don't think that actually any I think that it's very hard to convince an entire population that everyone is at risk. More people want to identify those people they can think of as the most likely, the most vulnerable, and then it's very easy to then make the assumption that, well, if I'm not in those categories, then I must be relatively safe. I think of my son, who's in his early 20s, who said to me longingly yesterday, the day before, I could fly anywhere in the U.S. for under $100. And I said, yes, but you can't go into an airport. And he said, but if I could go into an airport, I could get anywhere. And he said, anyway, you know, it's not going to really affect me. And I just thought, okay, we have a long way to go here. But there is an element to thinking about. If we talk about how certain populations are vulnerable for getting very sick and possibly dying, we also need to be aware, and this is a public health problem, that there are other groups that say, well, if I'm not very likely to get very sick and die, then perhaps really it shouldn't be that big a deal for me. And so you can imagine, you know, taking your children to a restaurant because you think, well, they're children. They're not part of those groups that have been identified as most vulnerable. So I've been thinking a lot about this issue of sort of identifying what we used to call, I think it's not an acceptable public health word anymore, but spreaders or transmitters. You know, how do you have people identify themselves as potential transmitters of something that is not causing any symptoms whatsoever in your own body? And I think that that's a major problem.
You're listening to Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Tom Breen, and we're talking today with Naomi Rogers and Jason Schwartz about the historical context of this particular pandemic and other pandemics that this world has weathered. Naomi Rogers is a professor of the history of medicine in the section of the history of medicine and the program in the history of science and medicine at Yale University. And Jason Schwartz is an assistant professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Yale School of Public Health. Jason, I wanted to move on to another pandemic that the U.S. has weathered. You mentioned the 1976 swine flu, and I'd love to hear a bit more about that. But let me frame it, if I can, around an issue that I think a lot of New Haveners are concerned with, and that's the way that pandemics affect cities disproportionately. The New York Times ran a fascinating article this morning about how pandemics seem to be fundamentally anti-urban, and that they attack every impulse that brings people together in cities. Cities are places of, you know, social gatherings at restaurants and bars and music venues and, you know, apartment buildings. You know, cities exist to bring people closer together, which is the exact opposite of what people should be doing in times of pandemic. So either in the context of the 1976 swine flu or any other pandemic you'd care to reference, are cities always kind of disproportionately hit? And do you think of pandemics as fundamentally anti-urban? Is that a helpful conceptual framework to use?
No, interesting. So yeah, so two pieces. I'll sort of take them in tandem. With respect to cities, if we think about our great historical knowledge of outbreaks over the last 300, 400 years, that cities have been such a prominent site for thinking about infectious disease outbreaks, from cholera in the 18th century in New York to plague in 1900 in San Francisco, to so many other diseases we can rattle off. And it's a function of density. It's a function of populations being close together. It's been a function of migration and throughout this history as well. So cities absolutely provide fertile petri dishes for the identification and the dissemination of infectious diseases, but it's also been a site where public health infrastructures, public health departments, public health agencies have grown and innovated and taken the lead in understanding how to respond, what the appropriate responses are, and how to deploy those tools to identify, track, and mitigate those outbreaks. With respect to 1976, that's sort of an interesting counterexample that's been coming up in this conversation. The 1976 swine flu pandemic was a pandemic that wasn't. It was a cluster of cases of a novel influenza in a military base in New Jersey that triggered a massive government response in the coming months, despite no additional cases beyond those first 11 or 12 or so, which triggered a massive government response from President Ford and his administration, and up to and including a mass vaccination program, despite the fact that there were no additional cases and there were issues with the vaccination program, issues with vaccine safety. And it's held up as a counterexample of thinking about the need for balancing the leadership of scientific experts and scientific trusted scientific health officials with the responsibilities and challenges of political officials shaping how we respond to these outbreaks, and the need to think differently as we gain new information about what those threats are and what those threats aren't, to recognize that the messages we'll be getting from our health leaders will and should change as we know more. That didn't happen in 1976, and it's often described as a fiasco or as a debacle, or an example of how not to expect our government to respond when there is a novel threat that could be dire. And there were projections comparing that to 1918, even then, that were wildly off target. So it's the nature of the complexity involved there. 1976 is often a really good counterexample of frankly how not to marshal a response to a potential threat.
I would want to add there that I think that there's a continuing legacy, a sort of political and cultural legacy of the 1976 response to what was supposed to be a swine flu epidemic. And I was noticing this in Dr. Fauci's comments over the last couple of days, where he keeps saying, I know that many people will feel that this is too serious a response, that we are, it will sound like we are exaggerating. It will sound like we are, adding months to what may not take months, but it's much better and much safer to propose extreme possibilities than to offer tepid small ones and then find that we are running to catch up. And I thought to myself, I really feel that in part he's saying this as a sort of response to people's memory of this notion that both scientists and politicians were too quick to jump ahead. And so it's very interesting to watch that legacy that's still around of sort of, when is it appropriate, or when is it, who should we believe and why?
I want to stay on in the world of national politics for a second more, because before this pandemic really came ashore in the United States in a big way in the past week or two, every news junkie's eyes were focused on the, at least here in the New Haven Independent, was focused on the Democratic primary for the presidential nomination. And I'm not sure if anyone here watched the very odd and eerie debate between Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. Yes. In an empty Washington, D.C. CNN studio on Sunday. But a focus of that debate was on how each candidate, if president right now, would respond to the coronavirus pandemic. And I think if I could, in the most simplistic of ways, distill the two responses and kind of get to the core messages of both campaigns, the Joe Biden message was we need to marshal all of our attention and interest and public resources towards an immediate response to this pandemic, towards doing all of the kinds of social distancing and public health measures that are most effective to make sure that as many people as possible get tested and get affordable treatment. Bernie Sanders, as he has done for the past 40 years of his political life, said that this is, you know, revelatory of systemic structural inequalities in our healthcare system in particular, but also, you know, economically more broadly, and said that this is an opportunity to completely restructure how America delivers healthcare, how the insurance industry is set up and all that stuff. So all the same, maybe I'll go to Jason first and then Naomi, not asking you to say which message is correct, but is this, do you see this also as a time to reflect on the structural apparatus of healthcare in this country and how politics helped shape it? Or is the most immediate and most important message to focus on right now how to today mitigate, you know, the spread of the pandemic? Or those two may not necessarily be in conflict, but that's the word mess I'm throwing your way. I'll see your response.
Absolutely. I think the answer is all of the above, that we have an imminent unfolding public health emergency that requires an aggressive, focused, dedicated response to get over these coming weeks, perhaps coming months, in terms of to put out this fire that we're living in. But a thing about outbreaks and epidemics is they are ruthlessly effective at bringing to light deficiencies in our social and political system, in our social safety net, in our healthcare system. They shine a light on those failures of the structures in which we care for one another, in which we protect one another, in which governments do that as well. And that's certainly the case in terms of individuals with limited access to healthcare, for whom healthcare is unaffordable or unavailable, that the epidemics will particularly threaten the welfare and livelihoods of those individuals and families. So we have a short-term issue, more than an issue, a short-term crisis to navigate. But absolutely, here is that, you know, that we can reflect when there is a time to reflect on this experience and recognize that the systemic failures in our social safety net, health and otherwise, from employment, from waging, from other issues, that absolutely need the more sustained attention. So it's all of the above, to be sure.
Naomi, how do you see that?
I want to reinforce everything that Jason has just said. I think that Joe Biden made a very powerful case for the most pragmatic ways of dealing with a problem right now, and in essence, suggesting that this is the kind of leader that Americans should be thinking about, and that Bernie Sanders made a very powerful case for saying, if that's all that we do, we are not able to address the very profound structural issues that we see around us, not that might happen or that might happen in the future, but in fact, people desperately who are losing their jobs, who are losing their access to healthcare, who have very poor access to healthcare, and in no way, for example, does the most pragmatic proposals deal with the economic disruptions that we are also in the midst of. Last night, I saw Elizabeth Warren talking about proposals that she is going to suggest in the Senate to use this as an opportunity. Now, you can say that this is politicizing a pandemic, but my feeling is that every pandemic is politicized and culturalized, if that's even a word, and it's turned into more than it is. And so the question is, in what way will this make a powerful difference and potentially improve American society rather than the other way around? And in listening to her, she did not use this term, but I thought that she was sort of proposing a kind of coronavirus New Deal, right? So that we have a coronavirus panic and pandemic, and we can potentially take this moment to think about what can we do next in addition to the very important pragmatic and technical issues. So yes, I absolutely agree with Jason, and I also think that historians have long argued that what's really important about looking at epidemics in the past, and if you are unlucky to living through them in the present, is that they raise the issue of a society beginning to recognize, what does it value the most? What is it the most scared of? What does it most hope will change? And I think that we're in the middle of that particular moment as well.
Naomi, right now, if you go to the New York Times homepage, you'll see a story about Trump seeking an $850 billion stimulus to help prop up businesses amidst this outbreak. But this is something that I've been hearing, you know, maybe most frequently in the past day from local business owners who, after Governor Lamont joined the governors of New York and New Jersey to really shut down restaurants, bars, movie theaters, clubs, lots of businesses all of a sudden have absolutely no source of revenue and are also being told to help provide for their employees in this indefinite closure. And so I wonder if, Naomi, and then over to Jason, could you put in historical context a bit how the federal government, state government, local government has responded to the economic concerns of...
I've just stopped hearing you, so I'm going to guess what your last part of your last question was. It is true that in the past there have been many times when small businesses were asked by state and federal agencies to stop or to change their practices, recognizing that this was going to hurt the profits of the businesses and absolutely the people who worked for those businesses. And generally, I would say, looking in the past, and Jason can chime in here too, mostly politicians who have, and health officials who've demanded this, have not been especially sympathetic to the financial burdens in those particular epidemic moments. I think that we are in an interesting and different situation, and I think that it's no coincidence that when people start to think about whether there should be government responses, that they have two models that I'm noticing as a historian. One of them is the New Deal, in which the Depression can certainly be seen as a kind of economic pandemic, and also the years of Ronald Reagan and the effort to sort of transform the economic system so that you try to minimize a government rather than expand it. But here I'll stop and have Jason jump in as well.
Yeah, no, I think that outbreaks, you know, two are the same, but particularly ones on the scale of what we're living through now, they do shine a light in terms of how communities and individuals view their responsibilities to one another, and as well as how governments view their responsibility, how seriously they take their responsibility to respond to the needs of their communities, not just the medical needs and the disease control needs, but the long-term and the economic needs, particularly as we do think about these small employers and the hourly wage earners who are facing, you know, ruinous risks potentially here in the coming weeks. So these issues are always important, but again, you know, outbreaks, as I mentioned before, have such an effective way of bringing those issues into stark relief. And I think at the government level, you know, we're seeing this tension working out, particularly among the president and his administration, a tension with the scientific advisors and the dedicated career public health servants who have been sounding the alarm and at some period of time were sort of muzzled while the threat was being minimized, and political appointees who generally, and with respect to health and welfare, have rejected, I think it's not an overstatement to say, the idea that the federal government had this particular responsibility to support members of our community in need in an ongoing basis. So we're seeing an evolution, I think a productive evolution, at least in the context of this current crisis, to say there is a need, there's a role, there's a responsibility for the federal government to respond, not just with tests and masks and ventilators, which we know are critically important, but with the kind of economic support that will be necessary to allow us to get through it. And I think we've seen examples from that in the past, as Naomi has noted, but I think that's this transition that's happening now, which reflects how the short term and the long term are so closely connected.
So it's part of the show where I'm going to ask an unfairly ambiguous question, but it's deliberately so. And so there is no right answer. I'm just genuinely curious to see how you take it. And that's me. I'll go to Jason and Naomi first. Or I'm sorry, Jason first and then Naomi. And that's looking back to the Spanish flu from 1918, which we focused on a bit during the show. How long did it take the United States to recover from that pandemic? I'm not going to say economically or public health-wise or even what recover means, but when you think about, you know, the long-term impact on society, how would you go about responding to that question, Jason?
Yeah, so I lost you a little bit at the end there, Tom, but I think I know what you were getting at. I don't actually know. I'm not sure I know exactly what that long arc was in the 1920s as the World War I ended, and then we found ourselves obviously in a depression at the end of the decade. But it was transformative, right? As the historians who have focused on that period have reminded us, that it was wildly transformative in terms of the life, not just in the United States, but around the world at that time. So it was, whether or not that's the comparator for this piece of history in which we're living through, again, the history remains to be seen. But certainly, it transformed an era. It transformed the nation in which America was at the time in ways that didn't happen overnight. And I think, you know, as we draw these analogies to the present, we have a road ahead of us, both in the immediate weeks and months ahead, but also the longer term economic recovery and returning to normal. Whether 1918 is the playbook that we'll see, hopefully not, obviously. But you know, these are not fleeting moments in our history or our present.
I think I would also add to that, which was that it was such a devastating experience that many people have argued that it kind of scarred a generation, so that among other things, many people had come out of the First World War, you know, supposedly the war to end all wars, very cynical about the responses of every government, and simply really not believing that governments who claimed to have fought for peace had done that at all, and that that had been a very nasty and politicized Versailles peace agreement at the end of the First World War. And it led, I think, to a kind of generational cynicism, so that we often talk about the 1920s as an era of flappers, but more broadly, it was sort of an era of a generation. And I want to point out that many of these, of the young people in the 1920s, had lost one or both of their parents or other family members during the pandemic, so that they had, not to mention the First World War, so that they really had a kind of false gaiety that kind of said, you know, nothing good is going to happen. Why don't we just party on? And it was a really it's a hard time to look back on, I think, because there was a general sense that really you couldn't trust anybody. You couldn't trust your political leaders. Your public health officials hadn't saved your parents from this epidemic. People talked about peace, but you know that they had talked about peace before, and there had been a massive world war. So I think that it actually had a really kind of scarring legacy that took a long time to mend. I don't know if you can mend legacies, actually. I think that that potentially, not necessarily in the same way, but that potentially we could see the possibility of a kind of scarring legacy of this pandemic as well. Historians are not prognosticators, and I'm not going to try to guess what in particular, but I think that this has been a profound kind of psychic, physical, social, cultural, and financial shock. And I think that it would be wrong to imagine that, you know, a small stimulus package or something like that is going to just sort of fix the kind of ways that people feel about the experience of living through this pandemic.
You know, we've been speaking a lot about the United States, the impact of the pandemic here, and the government's response. Obviously, this is an international phenomenon, and we live in a uniquely globalized time with, you know, again, going back to how people communicate, how the really unfettered access to communication across the globe. I wonder if, you know, if in that kind of big picture conceptual framework, if pandemics are anti-urban, do they also encourage a certain level of internationalism, a certain level of, if not coordinated responses by different governments? Have you all in your own historical research seen that pandemics in an odd way inspire a certain sense of belonging to a world community, however fraught it may be at that moment?
Well, I would say that was the one of the reasons that after the First World War, the League of Nations founded a special health organization, which was the precursor to the WHO, and that was certainly also the reason that inspired the founding of the WHO after the Second World War. This sort of notion that disease doesn't stop at the border, but there's something about this pandemic, and Jason may disagree with me about this, that I have felt actually quite anti-internationalist. And so when people have talked about the, showing pictures of the globe and the increasing numbers, at least in much of the media presentation, it's felt more like a global threat than an opportunity for global communication. But you know, maybe I'm wrong, Jason.
No, I think you're right, Naomi. You know, one of the other unfortunate trends in outbreaks and epidemics and how they've been framed throughout history is that they often lead to blaming and responsibility pushing that targets particular groups, particular nations, particular others. And we see this from the 1900 plague outbreaks in San Francisco that focused, you know, disproportionately and cruelly on the Chinese American population. We see it with respect to the way in which diseases are named, the Spanish flu, the Ebola virus, named after the river in Africa where it was found. And we're even seeing in our current political moment, the president and his allies and defenders have taken to deliberately, even just today on Twitter, referring to this as the China virus, despite all of the encouragement of the global health community to say that's not helpful at best, or it's racist or bigoted at worst in terms of how it stigmatizes certain communities and goes against this idea that diseases don't have passports, which has been one of the responses we've heard, and that there is a need for global solidarity, global coordination in terms of our efforts and how we think about things, and not to tie diseases into this otherness or this foreign threat that may, frankly, fit into a broader worldview of our current leadership in Washington. So diseases, you know, it worked both ways. We know coordination and this global solidarity is critical, but there has been this unfortunate trend through the centuries of figuring out who's to blame and who's to target. And it's often foreigners, broadly defined, and often cruelly and unfairly.
I was hoping that question would lead to answers about international solidarity and finally coming together across, maybe the next time. as we wind down our conversation, I want to end with your reflections on this moment, and in particular, as you know, this is again going back to the the Parking Authority meeting I was at last night, you know, the director described this as more than just a fluid moment. It's like a gas. I mean, everything changes, you know, the main storyline changes seemingly every minute, not every day. And so maybe Jason first and then to Naomi, what kind of sub thread of this story, what part of this story, of this larger pandemic, have you been paying closest attention to beyond just the numbers ticking up in terms of positive tests and deaths? What part have you been paying close attention to? And then also to tack on at the end, what would you urge our viewers to pay most attention to as this continues for likely a long time to come?
Sure. No, so two threads that I'm looking at is I continue to be inspired by our dedicated public health public servants in here in New Haven, in Connecticut, in the federal government, these sort of lifelong public health servants who have been doing work for decades. It's not a work that brings lots of prestige or notoriety in typical circumstances, but it's so fundamental to keeping our communities safe and healthy. And I know the work that they're doing and our healthcare workers more broadly are doing is inspiring. And on that sort of, to be on a more hopeful note than my last response, I'm thinking about the ways in which individuals, we're hearing these stories about how individuals and communities are looking out for one another, are stepping up in part by just staying at home, but also by helping, checking on, you know, older neighbors who may need someone to shop for them, or, playing music outside of nursing homes that are no longer able to take guests. So in terms of the solidarity as an American populace, regardless of the political debates and anchor that we're seeing, I think that's something that's encouraging. And as we think about the legacy going forward, maybe that's that idea of how we think and look out for one another as individuals in New Haven and Connecticut and around the world is a hopeful moment that I'm encouraged, despite all the uncertainty and anxiety that we're seeing out.
Naomi, what part have, and also I'm not fishing for hope. You don't have to search for hope if it's not there, but I appreciate you going there.
I very much like what Jason said, and I would want to reinforce that. I do think that one of the things that I'm focusing on is the moments where our infrastructure is becoming more visible to ourselves, especially the public health infrastructure, but not it alone. I think that's potentially hopeful, but also potentially disturbing as we see what, for example, in public health departments still exists and what has been cut back by funding cuts and so on. I think that nursing homes are a really good example where they are hunkering down as individuals have been asked to do, but of course they're institutions as well. So how do you institute social distancing within an institution? I think that this is a source of great concern, for example, within prisons and other institutions, which certainly want to isolate themselves from the outside world, but are also very concerned about what it means to be in a closer environment. And I'm not sure that we have I'm not sure that we have good answers for some of these questions yet. The other thing I would say that I'm focusing on is the effort to make people feel better with the references to a vaccine. And I have to say that in the past, this has always been true. The people have always said, oh, don't worry, we'll have a vaccine, or B, we have a vaccine. But in fact, that this in no way, therefore, somehow mitigates all the other public health restrictions that the public is being urged to follow. Because you have a vaccine or because you might have a vaccine, in no way then means that, maybe as soon as the vaccine is developed, you can all then not worry about social distancing anymore. And so I'm really interested in the way that vaccine is presented as a kind of way to have people feel better, even though it is a technical fix that may well help in the future, but it'll be a long future to come.
Well, I think that's as appropriate a place to end as possible. It may seem like unprecedented times right now, but I so appreciate you two helping provide the historical context of how the United States and the world have suffered through pandemics in the past, and how waiting for a magic bullet of a vaccine is not the best public health response, that social distancing, maintaining safe distances from people, not congregating when the pandemic is exacerbated by getting together in such large gatherings is the best way forward. So Jason Schwartz is an assistant professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Yale School of Public Health. Naomi Rogers is professor of the History of Medicine and the Section of the History of Medicine and the Program in the History of Science and Medicine at Yale University. Thank you to both so much for coming on the show and helping elucidate a bit of the history and provide a path forward in these really trying times. So Jason and Naomi, thank you, and please stay healthy and safe, and we'll talk to you soon, I'm sure.
You as well, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
All right. You can check out the newhavenindependent.org for an archive of interviews on Dateline New Haven, but also for breaking news about everything local and COVID-19 related. There's multiple stories a day going up on the uniquely local impact of this pandemic. So please do check it out. We're trying to stay on top of the story to keep you all informed as well. So thank you again, and we will talk to you all soon.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you very much. Let me just text. Perfect. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. I hope that was a helpful way to think about the pandemic, because it was great for me. I certainly learned a lot.
Fantastic. It was great.
Thank you.
Well, I'll send you a link to the article. I'm going to write an article about our competition. But,
okay.
That's it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Great.
I'm going to talk to you soon.
Bye-bye. You bet.